This is Steve Sherlock with number 32 in the Internet Radio or podcast series for Franklin Matters. This session is a special one. On Wednesday evening, February 25th, 2009, there was a presentation on the JFK assassination here in Franklin at the Thomas Mercer Auditorium in the Oak Street and Horace Mann Complex. Franklin resident Bill Glynn presented an overview of the events leading up to and around that fateful day, November 22, 1963. Abraham Bolden, the first African-American member of the Secret Service, came to Franklin to tell his story. The opportunity to hear Abraham in person was taken by about 50 to 60 people of all ages in the auditorium that evening. Now you can share in that opportunity. What follows is going to be the audio recording of Abraham Bolden's talk. In his voice, you'll hear him tell of growing up in East St. Louis, rising from a Pinkerton detective position to the Illinois State Police, and from there to the Secret Service. In the Secret Service, he met with John F. Kennedy a couple of times, once in Chicago, and then also at the White House, where Abraham was stationed briefly. One quote to keep in mind as you settle in for this little over an hour of Abraham's story, from the philosopher Antonio Gramsci: "The challenge of modernity is to live without illusions and without becoming disillusioned." I don't think you'll find Abraham's talk long. I found his first-person narrative riveting. His direct, honest, and religious approach to life comes through. I think you'll find that as well. And you'll begin to understand how the echoes of Dealey Plaza still reverberate today. I want to thank Bill and Abraham for allowing this recording to take place. Thank you. It is much appreciated. I think sharing this will help to continue the discussion.
Mr. Abraham Bolden is with us tonight. And first of all, people are always asking me frequently, once in a while, they ask me, what kind of books would I recommend? And just if you're interested, the three books. The first one is Brothers by David Talbot. And that book is basically the front part of my presentation, which talks about what was going on. And when you get to the conclusion of the book, you realize that if, you know, Oswald or whoever you believe didn't kill him, there were several groups waiting in line with a ticket number. Every one of these groups had reason, in their own mind, had reason and desire to kill Kennedy. Second one is Crossfire by Jim Mars, which has, you know, I'm not saying it's a completely accurate book, but it gives a lot of the story of what went down, what the evidence was, and, you know, it puts a lot of it together to give you a good baseline. The last one is our guest book. It's called The Echo from Dealey Plaza by Abraham Bolden. And this is a book that came out. When it came out, I saw it in the stores, kind of glanced at it at the cover, and just, you know, it wasn't one of the books that was high on my reading list. I didn't tell Abraham this over dinner last night. But it took a little while, you know. I read a few other books, and it kept catching my eye every time I went into Barnes & Noble's. And finally did get the book, and I read the book, and just was an unbelievable story. And he's going to share some of that with you. So I would definitely recommend that. That's, you know, basically what happened afterward. And I'm not going to give anything away because I'm not sure what he'll cover, but fascinating read of what went on and lends credibility to it. So, for the students in particular in the audience, it's always difficult to stand up for what you believe in when the odds are stacked against you. When things aren't easy, and you need to stand up for what you believe is right, and people are pressuring you to do something different, go along to get along, it's extremely difficult to do that. And when you do it in the face of high stakes, high personal stakes, these are the people that we tend to refer to as heroes. We are fortunate enough to have one of those heroes with us tonight. I am personally honored to call him one of my new friends. Please welcome Abraham Bolden.
Thank you, Bill, for a very informative session you had there. very, very interesting. I learned a few things myself. I really did. First thing I want to do before I start into my presentation, I always give praises to God for Him permitting me to be here tonight. And I also like to give praises to my devoted wife of 49 years who passed on a few years ago, who was dedicated to me and dedicated to God, and was my right hand. She was my right hand, and I miss her very much, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit as we go down the line. As he said, I'm an ex-Secret Service agent. I grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, a poor town, dirt poor town. But back then, in the early 30s and 40s, East St. Louis was kind of a booming town, but it was still poor. But it was the headquarters for most of your stockyards. My father was a carpenter, and he also worked at two other jobs. He worked at the freight house, moving freight, and also at the packing house. But his real love was carpentry. He liked to build things. And I often admire him because of his mathematical ability. And he used to try to get me to do mathematics things, but actually math and I never got along too well. But he tried. Well, I grew up, as I say, in East St. Louis, Illinois, and I'm going to say this for the young ones there. When I was a young man, the woman that I finally married, what I grew up with, Barbara Hardy, was my neighbor. We grew up together, and we used to sit around in the backyard and make mud pies together. And she made some pretty good mud pies, too, back in there. I don't, these young ones probably don't know about mud pies, but the old ones do. And so we went to a grade school together, high school together, and she was a friend of the family. But one thing, as we were growing up, I used to pick on her all the time. As I said, she was a neighborhood girl, lived a couple of doors down. And I used to run up behind her and pull her hair all the time, just pull the two flats in the back of her head and hit her behind the knee, you know, and make her fall. So one day she went in the house and she told my mother, I guess I was about 13 years old then, she told my mother that I had stuck a broomstick in the spokes of her bike when she rode by, you know, which I did. I was guilty of it. And she had a scar on her knee. And my mom called me and she says, Abraham, why do you keep bothering Barbara? I said, because I don't like her, because she's skinny. My mother looked me in the eye and said, I know why you keep bothering Barbara. I said, because you like her and she won't pay you any attention. And I said, I don't like her. I ran outside and looked for her. I wanted to beat her up again, but anyway. I went off to college, and the last time I'd seen Barbara was she was about 15 years old. I went away to Lincoln University. I had a music scholarship there into Milligan University, but I chose Lincoln University. So I went away, and Barbara was still a neighborhood girl. So I came home for Easter, and I'm saying this mostly for the young ones that are here today. And my mother said, you know, son, she said, it's Easter Sunday, the church going to be crowded. She said, why don't you run me to church so I don't get, lose my seat? She said, you, everybody's going to be out there on Easter. She said, you take me to church and you come back and get Dad, and the rest of you come on out later. Because, yeah, I don't want to miss my seat. I said, okay, Mom, I'll take it. So I took my mom off and dropped off at St. Paul Baptist Church. And on the way back, I turned the corner at the 13th of Missouri near St. Luke Church. And I saw this beautiful young lady. And she was walking down the street. She had on a white dress. And she had this flower in her hair. And like I said, I hadn't seen Barbara since she was about 15 years old. She was about 18 and a half then. And oh man, what a difference between a 15-year-old girl and an 18 and a half-year-old girl. So as I turned the corner, I looked to my left and I said, oh man, what a pretty girl. And I went back around the corner and came back again. I said, gee, Monique, that looks like Barbara. So I went around the corner and came back again. I said, hey, Barbara. And she threw up her hand and she waved. And what did she do that for? We were married that next December. We got married and had three children and at the wedding of my wife's uncle's house. My mom walked up to me after the reverend had finished, and she looked me right in the eye and said, I told you so. And we stayed married, as I said, for 49 years. Well, I always had wanted to be two things in life. I had wanted to be a musician and a policeman. Now, those things kind of conflicted. I became a fairly good trumpet player. At the age of about 15, I was playing on a riverboat. I was playing with Edna Deal and Associates in St. Louis, Missouri. We were going around giving talent shows and things like that. They called me Little Satch. That's what they used to call me in the honor of Satchmo Louis Armstrong. And while I was away in college, this yearning to become in law enforcement just kept pulling at me. It seemed like it was just tagging at me. And whenever I would see injustice, I would always have to open my big mouth about an injustice. And it kept me in trouble a lot of time. Because wherever I saw injustice, I wanted to fight. Well, when I graduated from school, I had a choice. I could either take a job in Southeast Missouri, teaching music, or as my wife saw a job in the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, she saw it in the Post-Dispatch, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She says, Abraham, she says, now, I know you got this teaching job you're looking at, but you've been talking about being a policeman too. Why don't you go and apply for a Pinkerton job? It's close to home. We won't have to move or anything like that. The salary was about the same. Nothing. And so I told my wife, I said, they're not going to hire any Negroes over at Pinkerton. They don't have any Negro detectives over there. She says, well, you never know. She says, cut out the advertisement in the paper and take it with you. And so Monday morning, I got up. This was in 1956, and I put on my best Sears and Roebuck suit, and I went over, and I walked into the office, and I said, my name is Abraham Bolden. I came to apply for the job for Pinkerton National Detective Agency, and the girl was sitting there typing, and then she says, we're not hiring. I said, oh, yes, you are, and I reached up in my pocket and I laid the advertisement on the desk. And she looked at me and she said, Colby, we're not hiring people like you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I had thought. And I was getting ready to give up and I turned around and I was getting ready to walk out of the office. And the manager of the office had overheard the conversation when I came in. His name was Mr. Mertz. And he was the district manager of Pinkerton National Detective Agency for St. Louis and Michigan, Indiana, and just the whole district he was. And he came out and he said, what seems to be the problem out here? And the young lady told him, say, this man came in, he wants a job, but I told him we're not hiring. He said, yes, we are. He says, have him to fill out an application, and when he does, have him to come in and talk with me. And I filled out the application. And I went in and talked to Mr. Mertz. He said, you understand, Mr. Bolden. He says, I see here you graduated cum laude from Lincoln University. He says, you're a good candidate. He says, but you realize that we don't really have any Negro detectives. He said, now we have them in uniform guards, but we don't have any investigative detectives. He said, if I hire you, you'll be the first one. Yeah, I said, well, I really need the job. And he says, well, I'll do a background investigation and we'll see what we come up with. About a week later, he called me and told me to come into his office. I went into his office. He said, Mr. Bolden, he says, I want to congratulate you. He says, you're the first Negro Pinkerton detective that we've hired internationally. I said, thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much. I was very flattered by that. And it seemed like, you know, my life had been always calling to me to be a pioneer. I seemed to get myself in those situations. So my wife was reading the paper again. She was a paper reader, and she says, "Abraham, the Illinois State Police are hiring." She says, "You're complaining about the money you make, and you know what?" Then we had a baby coming on then. You know, I really had to get down to the dirty thing. So she says, "Why don't you apply for the state police job?" I said, "Okay." And I went and applied for a state police job, and I got it. So I went to Springfield and was trained as the Illinois State Policeman and rode up and down the road in the big hat, you know, the big smoky hat, and things like that until they inducted me into the Illinois Investigative Services in the state of Illinois, which I served for about a year. Now, the state police, everybody knows what a state policeman does. But in 1960, there was a young man who was running for president of the United States, and his name was John F. Kennedy. And as I said, then I was the Illinois State Policeman. There was a special agent in charge, Fred Baxter, was coming, came to Peoria, where I was stationed, as the Illinois State Policeman. And they assigned me, see how coincidences work, they assigned me the escort, the Secret Service agent, special agent in charge, around Peoria, in preparation for Kennedy's visit to Peoria, Illinois. So during the process of me carrying special agent in charge Baxter around, I asked him, I said, "Mr. Baxter," I said, "do they have any Negro agents in the Secret Service?" He says, "I don't think so, Abraham." He says, "But with your background and your educational record, why don't you apply? We'll see where it goes." So I applied for the United States Secret Service. And went to Springfield, Illinois, took the test, and on October 30th of 1960, I became a United States Secret Service agent. So I was moving up. So I thought, well, when I came to Chicago, Kennedy did come, by the way, to Peoria, and I got a chance to see him there. And I got a chance to see some of his bodyguards. He didn't have Secret Service protection then, but he had other protection that were acting instead of the Secret Service. And I saw this young, dashing man, and he was waving and smiling and everything. And I took a liking to President Kennedy, as many of the African Americans did, as many people did. I thought that he was sincere. I watched the Nixon-Kennedy debates and things like that, and he really said some things that touched my heart. He impressed me as a person who wanted equal opportunity and justice under the Constitution of the East United States of America for all Americans, regardless of race, creed, ethnic background, anything. He wanted a democracy that was a reality for everyone in the United States of America. That's how President Kennedy impressed me. Well, when I was transferred, came into the United States Secret Service, they transferred me to Chicago, Illinois. And it just so happened that in April, while I was Secret Service agent in Chicago, President Kennedy was coming to Chicago to McCormick Place in order to thank Mayor Daley, who was a big-time machine politician in Chicago, for his part in getting all of the votes out, which put him over where he could win the election as President of the United States. Well, we were sitting around this big table in the office of the United States Secret Service, and they were giving out assignments. And they were placing agents in different places where they were going to be at McCormick Place. Well, when they came to my name, there were agents who were stationed at the banquet table. There were agents who were sitting in front of the table. There were agents at the doors and things like that. Well, when they came to my name, they put me on the lower level of the place where Kennedy was supposed to be speaking at McCormick Place, the lower level Gardner washroom. That's where they put me. And they made jokes about me. They told me what detail I had. Normally they would put a uniformed policeman there because it was kind of difficult. You know, people didn't really realize that I was an African-American Secret Service agent. There I am standing there in my cheap Sears and Roebuck suit and telling people that they can't use that washroom. It was kind of difficult. It would have been much better if a uniformed policeman man that type of detail. But they put me there, and they were laughing and joking about it. I really wanted to see President Kennedy as I stood in front of that washroom. Well, about 8:30 p.m., the president was running a little late, and I heard all of this commotion at the top of the steps, and I saw cameras flashing and reporters were stumbling over each other, and they were jockeying for position and everything. And I'm standing there to watch you. I just couldn't see what was going on. And I was sort of disheartened for that. But all of a sudden, I look up at the top of the steps, and here comes President John F. Kennedy down the steps. The first thing that he wants to do when he alights from his automobile was use the washroom, and there I stand. So the president comes down the steps, and he's followed by all of the political dignitaries of Illinois. Everybody was trying to be close to President John F. Kennedy. And as he was going into the washroom, he stopped right in front of me. And he looked at me and with such a beautiful smile and a twinkle in his eyes. The president says, "Are you a Secret Service agent or are you one of Mayor Daley's finest?" I said, "I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President." And one of the agents who were standing behind him said, "That's Agent Bowman." And he's stationed here in Chicago. The president looked at me and he smiled. He says, "Glad to meet you, Agent Bowman." He said, "Tell me, Mr. Bowman," he said, "has there ever been a Negro on the White House detail, Secret Service detail, guarding the president?" I said, "Not to my knowledge, Mr. President." He looked at me and he smiled. He said, "Would you like to be the first?" I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. President." He says, "I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And on June 6, 1961, I became the first African-American Secret Service agent to be assigned to the presidential detail in Washington, D.C. A great honor. It just goes to show you know, when there's a divine plan at work, you just never know what's going to happen. So you take life as it is and you try to enjoy it and do the best you can. But I went to the White House detail, and really that's where my problem started. I had been up against racism all my life. At that particular time, you know, I had been a so-called Negro a long time. And I expected to run into some racism, but not within the Secret Service itself, not that time. And it was so focused in the Secret Service. My supervisor, as I bring out in the book, and he was a supervisor within the Secret Service. On occasion here in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, he looked me right in my eye. And this was my supervisor, a man who is guarding the president of these United States of America. He says, "Bolden, I want to tell you one thing, and don't you ever forget it." He says, "You're a nigger. You were born a nigger, you're going to die a nigger, and you'll never be nothing but a nigger. So act like one." And this was a Secret Service special agent in charge of the detail protecting President Kennedy. And the conduct of the agents who were surrounding the president was horrible. They were drinking on duty, they were drinking on in flight, they were cabareting, they were carrying women around in a government car, and all of this Secret Service agents guarding the president. And worse than that, we had agents in the near proximity of the president who would be standing next to him. And I heard the agents say, if someone take a shot at President Kennedy, I won't take a bullet for him. I'll let it happen. He need to be assassinated. And I thought, what? A Secret Service agent saying that, and he's right there in front of the president, and it was all evolved around Kennedy's stand for racial integration. They hated him for it. They called him a nigger lover. And these are people who are, as I say, who are standing in front of it with the suits and ties on and the fedora hats and these different things. And they were using such terms as that. And I was so disappointed at what was going on in Kennedy's... I wanted to walk up and tell President Kennedy himself. But, you know, it's like being in the Army. You go through the chain of command. So you go to your immediate supervisor first. Well, my immediate supervisor already told me I would be nothing but a nigger. So that was no need of going there. So when I got back to Washington, D.C., I went to the chief of the United States Secret Service, U.E. Barton, and told him in no uncertain words, I said, Mr. Barton, if an attack is made on President Kennedy, it's going to be successful because the agents are not going to react. They're saying that they're not going to protect the President of the United States. And there is so much racism there, they hate the President of the United States because of his stand on civil rights. And I sung this same song, I kept singing this song to all of the supervisors that I could report to. And they did nothing. They made no changes within the detail of the United States Secret Service. As a matter of fact, because of my complaints about the president's security, my name became mud. They began to watch me and to do and say certain things about me. I was trying to save the president's life because, as I said in my book, I saw it coming. Now, I asked to be off the detail. I'd say I no longer wanted to be on the Secret Service detail in Washington, D.C., after my 30-day probationary period, after my supervisor had told me what he told me, I asked that my assignment be back in Chicago because it was such a dangerous situation. Here you have people who would look you in the eye and make such disparaging remarks to you about your heritage, your race, and everything else. And it's no plaything. We're all carrying weapons. And sometimes, you know, things flare up, they get out of hand. And I'm carrying a .357 Magnum and some of the other agents are carrying the same amount of weaponry. And things happen. People explode, they lose. And I didn't want anything like that to happen. And simply because I knew that President Kennedy was dependent on me to keep my cool, and he knew that I was going to go through something, because he was a very wise man. When I was in the White House on duty one day, President Kennedy was letting out one of these cabinet meetings, and I happened to be standing right in front of the White House door. And as Senator Hubert Humphrey and Senator Barry Goldwater walked out of the Oval Office, they left the door open, so I went to reach in to close the door. And the president looked up and he saw me. And he says, Mr. Boland, I see that you made it here. And I tell you, I was shocked. I say, he's the president with all Vietnam and everything on his mind. He calls me Mr. Boland. He's looking out for Mr. Boland. And so he carries me around. He introduces me to Evelyn Lincoln, his secretary, and to... And to Andrew Hatcher, who happened to have been the first black press secretary. He's just introducing me to senators and all of these type of people. And he comes to Pierre Sottinger. And he says, Pierre, come over here. I want you to meet somebody. Pierre came home and he says, I want you to meet Mr. Abraham Bolden. So he's the Jackie Robinson of the Secret Service. And I just saw that one. You know, Jackie Robinson, we all know what Jackie Robinson had to go through, but he was telegraphing to me that he expected a lot, and I had a lot to give him. Now, when I came back to Chicago and went back into the counterfeiting and check forgery investigation, there was, in 1963, starting early in 1963, we began to get these serious reports of organized thugs who were going around the country following President Kennedy, the assassinator. There's no question about it. We had a report, a Miami report, and this occurred in October of 1963. The Secret Service, in conjunction with the sheriff's office in Miami, Florida, had a tape, had a recording of conspirators who were discussing on the telephone the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, I learned about this from record meetings that the Secret Service had. Nobody believed me when I first brought this out before those reports were declassified. But I knew about this right after Kennedy was assassinated. But anyway, they were discussing assassinating the President of the United States and saying, what's the best way to kill President Kennedy? And the man on the other end of the telephone, who we identified, said the best way to kill President Kennedy is from a tall building with a high-powered rifle and a telescopic sight. That's the best way to kill President Kennedy. And they said, well, you know, he's surrounded by so many Secret Service agents. And the answer and the reply was that the more agents are there, the better. Now, why would they say a thing like that? Also, in October 1963, we had a man named Homer Asher Laird in Chicago. He was in Chicago. And he told a Secret Service informant, and this was in October of 1963, President Kennedy is about to be taken care of. Says we have enough finances now to do the job. And sure enough, President Kennedy was assassinated. Now, where do I fit into this? Where I fit into this is that I knew and I had this information that the public didn't have. The researchers didn't have this information at the time that the Warren Commission was first appointed. All of these memos were locked up. But I knew that these investigations had existed. Now, after the president was assassinated, the United States Secret Service, in conjunction with the FBI, began to strip the files of all of the results of these investigations and remove certain names from the file and send them directly into Washington, D.C. Some files were burned. We were told to turn in all of our information about the Asher Vera case and about another hit that was to take place on November the 1st of 1963. To murder President Kennedy. Now, there's been some controversy. Some researchers are saying, well, the congressional committee who investigated said that they couldn't prove this conspiracy that Bolden is talking about that happened on November the 1st about the Cubans who came to Chicago to assassinate President Kennedy. We had a call that there was a team of Cubans in Chicago with high-powered rifles there to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. Now, the review board was not able to confirm that, but one of the researchers, Jim Douglas, he came and he talked to me, and he was able to do investigation on that, and in his book, which is the unspeakable. JFK the unspeakable. He investigated the claim that I made, and he was able to find out that there indeed was a conspiracy going on then, and that President Kennedy was supposed to be assassinated from a tall building when he reached Jackson Street, just as I had said. Now, while the government couldn't find that out, and a researcher who doesn't have near the authority of the government, it leads me to believe that somebody's sitting on a lot of information they don't want the public to have. Now, I couldn't stand to see my president's brains blown out at noon in Dallas, Texas. He was the president of the United States of America. The presidency is an official office established by these constitutions of the United States of America. The presidency is not one man, is not John F. Kennedy, is not Barack Obama. It was not Nixon, but it's in the official office of these United States of America. And we cannot afford to stand idle and let our government fall into a situation where its changes are going to be by assassination, coup, poisoning, and all of these other things that are happening in some of these other countries. See? I grew up in a democracy, and I intend to leave the benefits of that democracy for my children, their grandchildren, your children, and their grandchildren. So now at 70-some years old, it's a mighty small sacrifice that I'm making for the life of generations to come after me. Because I feel like we have a duty to get to the bottom of who assassinated our President of the United States of America. Because it is the office that was assassinated, not the man. We have to look at the broader picture. And no matter where it falls, we have to be ready to stand and take action against it. Now, I preached that for many years in the Secret Service, the 3 years, and after President Kennedy was assassinated, and I was reading in the newspaper where the Warren Commission was interviewing different people about the assassination, I kept looking for the names. I would say, where is the name Ashaver? Where is the Miami investigation? Everything is not getting to the Warren Commission that I know about. Where is the description of Lee Harvey Oswald that came on the teletype to the Secret Service right after President Kennedy was assassinated that said the assassin was a stocky blonde about 30 years old, about 5 feet 9 inches? Is that Lee Harvey Oswald? Well, that's what came on the teletype. Now, I'm not saying that I can solve everything, but I'm telling you what I know. And it doesn't take a big conspiracy in order to put researchers off track. Everybody's looking for the big lie. No, just that little turn, that little twist can throw you so far that you'll never find out what the truth is. As Jesus said, a little leaven is a whole loaf. That's what he says. You put one little lie in there and you poison the whole truth about it. And that's what was going on with the government. I knew that there was a bullet hole that went through the windshield of the president's car. I knew that. But you don't know that for a fact. I knew the day that Harry Gagline went out behind the White House, the car was parked behind the White House, and they found a bullet hole that went all the way through the windshield. Researchers are searching now today, but it might be 25 years from now. You children, listen to this. You will find out that Abraham Bolden spoke one night in your hometown, and he told you that a bullet hole went clear through the windshield, which means there was a fourth shot, at least at a minimum of four shots. And so what happened? I know because I was sitting there listening to agents who were going back and forth to Washington, D.C. The Secret Service decided to change the windshield. They took the windshield out and put another windshield in, and we were told to keep our mouth shut under the penalty of removal from the United States Secret Service and some other things. We were threatened. I know about these things. And now the old windshield has been destroyed. Researchers are running around right now today looking for the old windshield. When they go and view the car where they have it stored, it's got a brand new windshield in it. But I know. So what did they do? I went to Washington, D.C. I said, somebody's got to get to the Warren Commission about some of the things that I know. Now, I'm not claiming I know everything. I can't name no conspiracy and say such and so and so shot the president. But I know that the Warren Commission didn't get all of the information. And so I said, well, maybe I can tell them a few tidbits, give them a little information, and put them on the right track. So when I went to Washington, D.C., May 17, 1964, I tried to call J.B. Rankin, who was the counsel of the Warren Commission. I dialed a White House switchboard, but they had another agent who was following me. And he went into the booth. I bring this out in my book. I even named the agent. He went into the telephone booth right next to mine. And when I dropped my dime, and the young people don't know about the dropping a dime at the telephone, but it made a ding ding noise when he said ding, and that lets you know that you're down at risk. So I'm in one telephone booth, and Agent McLeod is in the one next to me. But I don't hear a dime drop. So I figure that he's trying to overhear my conversation. Who am I talking to? Well, I had to abort the call. But the call was registered at the White House switchboard because whenever you call way back then, they made a note of it. Well, the next day, the inspector of the Secret Service, Jerry McCann, and McLeod, he brought me back to Chicago. All of a sudden, they got a big investigation. They need me back in Chicago. They lied. He said, we need you back in Chicago as fast as possible. This investigation is hot, and you are a top undercover agent. So he brought me back to Chicago. The next thing I know, I'm in the United States Attorney's Office. And I'm waiting there to go on the investigation, waiting to be briefed on what I have to do. So in walks the supervisor of the Chicago office with the United States Attorney, it would be Hanrahan, and said, we're charging you with a federal crime. We're charging you with soliciting a bribe, conspiracy. And I couldn't believe it. I said, that's ridiculous. I figured this is part of an investigation, right? No, this was in actuality. These people brought me all the way back. They brought me to Chicago on a lot. And they charged me and took me to trial. Twice I went to trial. Now, I knew what it was all about, but my attorney was afraid, as I bring that in my book. He says that if you don't keep your mouth shut, they're going to blow your brains out. He said, you're dealing with people who killed the president at noon in a parade. So you better keep your mouth shut. We can't bring this thing up in your defense. I wanted to bring it up. But my attorney, George Howard, said in his better judgment that we should just concentrate on the charges that they lodged against me. Well, when I went to trial, the jury was deliberating. Now, everybody in here knows that the jury is the one who is supposed to pronounce you guilty or innocent. But the judge got up while the jury was deliberating. He called the jury out of the jury room. And he told the jury, he says, "Now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, in my opinion, the defendant is guilty of counts 1, 2, and 3 in the indictment." And then he says, "Now go back in and deliberate with the new information that I just gave you." And this is a federal judge. We're not talking about some Mississippi state judge way down south somewhere. We're talking about Chicago, Illinois. And that's what he told the jury. Well, that jury didn't find me guilty. So the judge held another trial. The same judge, the one that said I was guilty, he says that I'm going to listen to the second trial. Same judge. So I had a second trial. This time, while the jury was deliberating, the judge told the assistant United States attorney, empty the courtroom of everybody except government employees. They locked me and my attorney outside of the building. All the spectators outside. We were all locked outside. Nobody was in the whole federal building. It was 5:30 in the evening on a Saturday evening. And left only the government, the Secret Service, FBI agents, there were 2 CIA agents there who were observing, the jury, the judge. Those were the only people that was in that whole building, and they found me guilty. Of course they did. And as I say in my book, and I explain how I found out, that we found out that the judge indeed tampered with the jury. Because they locked me up with a person who had knowledge of that. See, they didn't take all of the safeguards and locking me up that they normally would take with a policeman. They put me, they locked me up with people that I had arrested. People who I had sent to prison when I went to prison for 3 years and 3 months. They were like walking around right in front of me. These were people that I had sent there. They sent me to some of the toughest prisons in the United States. I went to Terre Haute, I went to Fort Leavenworth. And I knew that they were trying to destroy me. They were trying to destroy my word, destroy my integrity, destroy the belief. See, you don't have to shoot a man in the back of the head to kill him. You can kill his reputation. You can kill all the things that he stands for. And he is as good as dead. You can kill his future employment. You can kill him before his wife, before his family, before his friend, before his neighbor. And he's dead. And that's what they had in store for me. And I knew from history and from how the government deals with such persons as I, who were considered to be such a problem. The first thing that they want to do is declare you insane. Because once they hang that insanity tag on you, you're finished. Nobody's going to believe anything that you say. I couldn't be here tonight if I had been declared insane. Brother Glenn wouldn't invite me here if he knew that I had been declared insane, because he couldn't trust what I said. So when they sent me to Springfield Medical Center in Missouri, I knew that they were about to hatch their plan, because I had researched institutions, and I knew from being an agent that at Springfield, Missouri, they have 4 different prisons there. They have a camp, they have a hospital, they have the psychiatric ward, and then they have the holding facilities there. I had done research on it because I knew that someday during my stay in the penitentiary that they were going to try to declare me insane. And sure enough, on July the 6th, 1967, I was in a camp. I had gotten in an argument with one of the psychiatric patients there. He accused me of using his mop bucket, and for that he was going to stab me with a 12-inch butcher knife. That's just how insane he was. And when I told him I was going to defend myself by throwing a bucket of boiling hot water in his face, then they accused me. They said that you can't discipline these patients here. And they tried to make it my fault that he came after me with a 12-inch knife. Well, that was just a front. They were going to do what they did anyway. So on that day, which was July the 6th, two guards came to my bed and they poked me in the side with a big 5-cell flashlight. And he said, "Let's go, Bolden." And at Springfield, the inmates called the psychiatric division of the institution, they called it the tomb. He said, because when you go there, it's no resurrection for you. You're not coming out of there. They call it the tomb. It's building 2-1 East. So it's 3:00 in the morning. I rose up on the side of the bed and I went to lace up my shoes. They said, "We don't have time for that." And so we started marching through Springfield, the institution there in the basement, and we walking out behind the guards. And I knew that this was it. So it was just me and the guards and God. Yeah. See, they didn't see him, but I did. I was carrying him in my heart. Because every step that I was taking, I was saying, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." Yes, I was praying because I didn't know how this was going to come out. You see, early in my childhood, children, I was your age and I was playing sandlot baseball. I'm going to get back to the story. I was playing sandlot baseball. And one of the players hit the ball and it landed and it kept rolling and it rolled into a pile of trash. We were playing like in a vacant lot. And the lady that lived upstairs there, she used to empty her bucket, her night chamber, down every morning. But this fire was just smoldering. It was smoldering, smoking. And I went to pick up the ball when I looked down. And there was a book laying, looked like it was right on top of the fire. And it was a greenback book. And I reached down and I picked up that book. And I brushed it off on my overalls. And it wasn't burned. It was laying in the fire, but it looked like the fire didn't burn it. And I brushed it off on my pants, turned it over, it looked like it was brand new. It said on the front, "The Holy Bible." And I began to take interest in that book. And I read that book every morning before I went to school. I would try to remember something from that book. And it stayed with me all of my life. I didn't think then on the day that it would come that that would be all that I had. There was nobody there but me and the powerful government who was trying to declare me insane and God. That's all that was there. And so as we neared this tomb that they were taking me to, you could just smell the stench, the closer you got to these big steel doors. And you could hear the patients. You could hear them in there screaming. Screaming all types of curse words. Throwing feces, I later learned as we were walking to my cell. They were throwing feces up against the door, howling like wolves. Some of them came to the big glass square, and you could see the beard just hanging down. These men hadn't shaved or anything for at least a year. And they feed them like animals in there. They have a little trap door at the bottom of the cell, and when it's dinner time, they bring the tray up, and then they scrape the food off the tray onto the floor on the inside, and the inmates get on their knees and eat their food like a dog. That's two on these, that's a two. And that's the condition that they put me under. A man is standing here before you today. So, I'll tell you this and then I'll wrap it up, but lo and behold, on the 10th day there, I suffered a little bit of claustrophobia. I wanted to get out of there so bad I didn't know what to do. I said every prayer that I knew. I called on every God that I knew. Because I knew that that was my only answer. Some laying on my bunk, children. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. The cell is just about pitch dark. You had all of the lights out. And I hear the sound of a little scratch, like somebody flick a cigarette light and it doesn't catch, it goes. And I looked up, kind of startled me. So I was laying on my back and I looked again. And I saw a flash, a little spark. And from that spark, a light began to shine, and it got brighter and brighter and brighter like the sun. And I'm sitting up there, I became numb. I was just numb. It was part fear. I didn't know what was taking place. Because they had been trying to force the psychotropic drugs on me while I was there. They say, either you take them or we're going to shoot it in your ear. But I found a way to avoid taking those drugs. I didn't take them. It was not a drug thing. But I feared for my sanity at that time. I feared for my sanity. I knew I was claustrophobic. And I knew that something was going on. And as that light got brighter and brighter and brighter, then it dimmed down a little bit, and then there was a figure of a person, the outline of a person. It was like a shadow. I can't tell you if he was a Negro, African American, a European, or what. But I'm gazing into this light. And then by telepathy, children, I wouldn't lie to you, God is my witness. Out of that light, a voice came, but that voice was not transmitted across space. It was transmitted from light to heart. I could feel it. I didn't hear the words. I felt the words. And the voice from that light said, "What is your name?" And I said, mentally, "Abraham." And the voice said, "How many children do you have?" And I answered, 3. And then the light said, "Fear not. God be with you." And then it started to die away. Now, children, you can think that I'm insane. I don't care if you think that I was insane. But the light began to die away. because I'm telling you what our master wants you to hear tonight. See, he didn't bring me all the way to Massachusetts just to talk about Kennedy. See, he wants you to know what actually happened, what is the real echo from D.D. Plaza. And so that same day, on that same day, I woke up in the morning. I was up just about all night, just dozing. And, you know, I was just trying to figure out what's going on. I recited the names of my children. I was trying to think, what day is it? I was asking myself questions, you know, questions and questions and questions to check in my own sanity because of what happened. Well, that morning about 8 o'clock, I'm sitting on the side of my bunk, naked as a jaybird, wanting to get out of there so bad, listen to those prisoners screaming. Then all of a sudden, I hear the fire alarms going off, ding, 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 and the guards are running back and forth, running back and forth. They say, what's going on? They say, it's a fire in the cell, 2 doors down from Boulder. The other guard answered back, he said, it can't be. He said, nobody in that room. He said, well, the air is burning. And then I thought about Almighty God when he was leading the children of Israel, in a cloud by day and by fire at night. So the deliverer, when he told me, fear not, he meant fear not. And so the next thing that they said was, get bolted out of there. And I walked out. I couldn't have done that by myself. But they still, children, you know, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He wanted me so bad because he is a young Negro man and he's uppity, and he's talking about the President of the United States and he's about to explode this thing. We gotta get this guy, no matter what it takes. So they put me on the list anyway, but they took me out of 21 East and put me in what they call C building, which is just as bad. But to prove I wasn't insane, after I saw this vision, the guards, I could hear them coming. Hear their feet running. And they came right directly to my cell. And they shine in this big flashlight and they looking up in the ceiling down and they looking right the flashlight. And I'm laying there like I'm asleep. And they looking for something. I said, oh, they heard something too. They saw something. See, because they control the lights from the outside. And when the angel came, the whole room was lit up. I know they had to see. So they put me in C building, and they put me on the list to go before the committee to declare me insane. Pharaoh was going to go through with it anyway. So the caseworker, who was the chief classification at parole, Judas Nichols, he talked to me in his office, and he tells me, you had a good job, and your big mouth messed it up. Says, we're going to declare you insane. When you get out of here, you won't even know your name. His name was Judas Nichols. So, they put me in C building for 20 days. On that 20th day, I was supposed to go before the committee to be declared insane. Now, you can believe I'm insane if you want to, but I had that same hypnagogic experience. That same light came. And when the light came this time, there was no message or anything there, except when it died away, it left the figure of a man hanging, going back and forth, back and forth. Well, this time I had more confidence, but I didn't know what it all meant. So now, this happened on a Wednesday. And I was supposed to go before the committee on a Friday morning at 9 o'clock. So the guards came and got me Friday morning. Put your clothes on, Baldwin. I put my clothes on and everything. And they took me into this big conference room, and they got all these doctors and things and associate wards and all of them. They sitting at a table. And I'm all geared up to defend myself and fight to the death if necessary. This is the government trying to declare me insane. I said, you're in serious trouble, young man. And I'm going to wrap it up here because I want you to read it in the book. But here's what happened. When I sat down at the end of that long table, the first thing that Mr. Gronsky said to me, Bolden, you can go back to the camp. And I was so shocked. I said, what happened? Here these people all geared up. Mr. Nichols said he's going to declare me insane and I won't know my name when I get out of here and everything. Hear me well, children. So I got my little things together. I took my Bible and I took a compass in there with me and a square and some things that I was working with and reading. So I go back to the camp. I got them all in a little pillowcase. When I reached the camp, I talked to my friend Gus. I said, he says, oh man, we're glad to see you back. I said, yeah, man, they were taking me before the committee this morning. I said, Julius Nichols, he didn't show up. He said, man, he says, Julius Nichols is dead. Julius Nichols is dead. He said, let me go get the paper. So he ran downstairs and he got the paper and brought it up there. Now, I just came out of isolation. I don't know anything about this. I found out that Thursday night, the night before, that Nichols is supposed to sign a warrant to declare me insane. He and his wife gets arguing. Now, he's chief of the classification and parole. They had an argument. He pulls out his service revolver, chases her down the street, shot her in the leg as she ran to the neighbor's house, turned around and ran back to his own house, went down in the basement, threw a rope over the pipes down in the basement, stood on a board, and hung himself. So who was crazy? Huh? Sure wasn't me. Here I am today. And I tell you, that's the real echo from DJ Class. Is for me to come and tell you wonderful people that God is. Trust in God. No matter what happened, no matter what the burden, remember a wise man said, pick up your cross and follow me. Remember that. Because you're going to come up against many things, young people, in this life. People are going to do you injustice. They're going to falsely accuse you. But you have to stand for something. You have to stand for justice. Stand for right. Stand for truth. Make a stand. People say, they may kill you. Well, I'm dead if I don't do what I'm doing. If a man refuses to stand up for justice, he don't deserve it. Huh? Then the people are going to walk in and take over this precious country of ours. If we who are my age don't sacrifice for you, there will be no hope. Huh? We have soldiers who are sitting in homes right now, having lost both legs, both arms. Some of them are blind. We have people who have died in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, for this precious government that we call a democracy. And someday you may be called to do your duty to the United States of America. Huh? And so it's a life theme for me to make a decision to stand up for truth and justice and to encourage others to do the same. Because in the long term, We must remain a government for the people and by the people and of the people if we're going to be a successful republic. I thank you very much.
This podcast has been a public service provided to my fellow citizens of Franklin, Mass. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.blogspot.com. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music intro and closing is from the PodSafe Music Network. John Schmidt, powerful, exhilarating piano music. I hope you enjoy.